Good evening and welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. My name is Garland Nixon and the show is called News Views. I'm on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica in Washington, D.C. We have a very, very interesting guest. And we deal with the latest news subjects, what's in the news. And we have award-winning authors. We have national and international authors and essayists. We have politicians. And we have notable people who are involved in notable things and issues. A lot of big things going on today. We've got a couple of we've got a couple of really good guests and a couple of very serious issues. The first half hour, we're going to talk with Nick Turse, who is the author of a great book called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And the second half of the show from 6:30 to 7 p.m., we're going to have someone from the ACLU. We're going to be talking about a very, very important thing that happened today, something a very, very important piece of legislation that went through the state of Maryland. The death penalty was repealed in Maryland today. And I think that's big news. That's exciting news. I talked to Kirk Bloodsworth, a good friend of mine. We're going to have on the show. He was a gentleman who was actually on death row in Maryland, who was exonerated by DNA evidence. And needless to say, he was a very, very happy man. He was celebrating an hour ago. He was starting his St. Patrick's Day weekend early, celebrating the death penalty's repeal in Maryland. We've got Mark.
Welcome, welcome. I'm glad to be here. I remember we had Kirk Bloodsworth on our show earlier, and he made a very powerful case, his own case, for abolishing the death penalty. It's something that it's really his dream come true. He's been working very hard at it ever since he was freed.
We're going to start with Nick Turse. Nick, are you with us? We have Nick here? We have our guest, Nick Turse, online? Nick, are you with us?
I'm on.
There we go. Okay, we've got you on. Welcome to WPFW, the show's news views here at WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., a Pacific affiliate. I'm on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. And today, as I said earlier, we have Nick Turse. He's the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick, welcome to Washington, D.C. Tell us, before we get started on your book, give us a little bit of background on who you are and what you've done, you know, leading up to the book and your professional life.
Well, I'm a national security reporter by trade. That's my day job. I work as the managing editor of a website called TomDispatch.com under the auspices of the Nation magazine and the Nation Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a freelance writer. I've written for the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, the Nation, lots of different publications, and I usually follow the U.S. military. That's my normal beat. And, you know, I've been a Vietnam War historian now for, I guess, for the last 15 years or so.
Well, you know, I guess you've probably been following what happened over there at CPAC, where Louis Gohmert made the statement. Representative Louis Gohmert from Texas Thursday asserted the U.S. war in, quote, Vietnam was winnable, but people in Washington decided we would not win. What I'd really like to know would be what his definition of winning was. But at any rate, let's talk about your book. And, you know, what caused you to write it, and then, you know, what it's all about, what your book is all about.
Well, there are 30,000 books out there on the Vietnam War, but not one that attempted to tell the complete story of what I came to see as the signature aspect of the conflict, and that's Vietnamese civilian suffering. Millions of Vietnamese were killed, wounded, or made refugees due to deliberate U.S. policies, like the almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So I'm talking about deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military, veritable orders to, you know, in effect, kill anything that moves. But when I looked at the literature, you know, basically, you know, any stories of civilian suffering are distilled down to one event, the My Lai massacre,
mm-hmm.
In which 500 Vietnamese civilians were killed over a period of 4 hours. And it's coming up on the anniversary. It'll be this weekend, March 16th, 1968, this happened. And basically, you know, if you look at books on the war, you get a couple paragraphs or a couple pages at best on My Lai, mm-hmm. and that's about it. But you know, I learned that there was a much larger story to tell, and that story I really stumbled upon mm-hmm. back when I was a graduate student. I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I would go down to the National Archives down your way in College Park, Maryland, and you know, I would look for hard data to match up to self-reports, what veterans had told us about their service. And on one of these trips, I was there for, I guess, about 2 weeks, and every research avenue that I went down was a dead end. Everything was a failure, and I finally went to an archivist that I normally work with there, and I said, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead, to take back. And he thought about it for a moment, and then he said a couple words that really ended up changing my life. He asked me if I thought that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress. And I told him I thought it was an excellent hypothesis, and I asked what he had in the way of war crimes. And within an hour, I was paging through thousands and thousands of pages of official military reports. And to call this an information treasure trove is really the wrong phrase. This was a horror trove. They were thousands of reports made by recently returned veterans and active duty GIs at the time, talking about massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation. It was a tremendous catalog of horrors, but it was one that I knew wasn't in the existing literature, and it was that research find that really set me along the path that ended in the book Kill Anything That Moves.
Great. And once again, we've got Nick Turse. He's the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Also, want to make sure our listeners know we have our panelists with us, the esteemed Mark Levine. Mark, are you in there?
I am here.
Okay. Feel free to join in if you have any questions for Nick at any time, Mark.
Sure. Actually, I do have a question for Nick, and that is, I mean, the Vietnam War, it's been 40 years, I guess, since the war ended. Why has this just come to light now? Why do you think that these additional massacres, things in addition to My Lai, haven't been exposed sooner?
Well, you know, one reason is this particular collection of documents that I found, the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group documents. They were assembled by a secret Pentagon task force. But the idea of this task force wasn't to prosecute war crimes, to prevent war crimes, to send guidance out into the field. Their job was to track war crimes cases for the top brass at the Pentagon and for the White House, and whenever it was possible, they were to tamp down war crimes allegations to make sure that the military wasn't, you know, caught flat-footed by another My Lai-type scandal. So they took active efforts to squelch cases, to keep them out of the public, and this was one of the major reasons. And you know, another reason that I talk about in the book is really complicity on the part of the press. You know, there was freer access to the battlefield in Vietnam, but there were a lot of hurdles when it came to editors, especially back in the States. Most of them weren't interested in telling the stories of war crimes if these came over the wire from Saigon. A lot of times they just get shelved because this wasn't the narrative of the war that they were interested in telling. So both of those, you know, had a you know, a chilling effect, and it caused a lot of these you know, reports of massacres to go unreported at the time.
Well, I hope this doesn't come across wrong, but something I'm thinking, and that is when I think about the My Lai massacre, and you say what there was maybe 500 people killed.
Yes,
there was what my understanding is something like 2.5 million Vietnamese who died, or somewhere in that range, something over 2 million at least Vietnamese who died. It almost seems to me that, and not, maybe not just with the My Lai massacre, but with other horrors that happen in military conflicts, that sometimes the military and maybe even the press will pick out one particular egregious and fairly obvious one and focus all the attention on that and kind of almost pretend like that was horrible, that was terrible, and we were all over it, and we addressed that, and we talked about how terrible that was, and kind of divert that from the attention that lots of other things. It almost kind of seems like they act as though you see how much we're on top of this and how much we're addressing this. That should tell you that we're honest and that anything like this we would address. And it kind of diverts our attention from the fact that the My Lai massacre, if 2.5 million people died, the 509 at one time could not have been all that rare.
That's exactly right. You know, the military has always portrayed My Lai as an isolated incident, and you know, and the work of, you know, quote unquote bad apples. And of course, we've heard this time and again with other atrocity scandals.
The old few bad apples defense.
That's exactly right. And you know, with the My Lai massacre, one thing to that people ought to keep in mind was it was really the only massacre that the military investigated to the extent that it did. Even the records that I found, nothing compared to the amount of time and effort that was put into the into investigating My Lai. And when the military actually did investigate the My Lai massacre, and they did a good job of it, you know, what they found really shocked them, and it was the reason why this war crimes working group was set up. The general who headed that, General Piers, it's called the Piers Commission. When he looked into the My Lai massacre, he didn't just find the 500 civilians killed at My Lai on March 16th. He also found that just a few miles away, a separate unit in a different village also carried out a massacre. This other massacre at a village called My Kay took somewhere between, you know, 60 and 150 lives, according to American witnesses on the scene. But, you know, when the Pentagon brass found out about this, I mean, it really puts the lie to the idea that that My Lai is isolated. If that very same morning, at the exact same time, another unit's carrying out another huge massacre, it really makes it hard to say that this is an isolated incident. So this was hushed up at the time. The files were made top secret, and these were also buried away. So, you know, you're exactly right that they used My Lai as a stand-in for, you know, all the other war crimes that came about, and the press, you know, they went along with this in a lot of respects. One thing to consider about My Lai is that it was exposed by Seymour Hersh, mm-hmm. who at the time had never visited Vietnam. He was a stateside reporter. At the time the My Lai massacre was carried out, there were 500 reporters in Vietnam. But none of them got the story. None of them thought to ask why, on the date of the massacre, the military reported a victory over enemy troops, 128 enemy soldiers dead at a cost of no American lives, with only 3 or 4 weapons to show for it. Now, something, you know, this should have triggered alarm bells with the press, but they just weren't looking closely at these at this type of thing. Many reporters were happy enough to copy down a Pentagon press release, and that was that.
Do you know who reviewed these papers before you did? I'm sure the military did, probably the executive branch, Richard Nixon in that day. But did Congress ever look at these papers? Did any of them apply under the Freedom of Information Act? Did any reporters look at them before you, or is this really new stuff that hasn't been discovered? And if it has been discovered, who looked at it and didn't disclose it to the rest of us?
Well, this was put together by a secret Pentagon task force that was run out of the Army Chief of Staff's office. At the time, that was General William Westmoreland, who had been the supreme commander in Vietnam a couple years before. So he had a vested interest in portraying the war in the kindest light. And this task force operated off the books. It was unofficial. It was just a collection of colonels under the command of one general in his office. So Congress really wasn't aware that this group was in existence. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't formally in existence. It was just a collection of officers under his command, and it went out of operation in 1975, and the documents were just buried away. And when I got in touch, when I was the records were brought to my attention, I asked an archivist who brought them out, you know, if anyone had worked with these records before. And what he told me was that a couple people had looked at individual cases, but no one had really delved into the records fully. So, you know, they had been sitting on the shelves for about 7 years before I found them.
So this was
they just didn't attract attention.
Hiding in plain sight. It existed 7 years because the Freedom of Information Act time period for top secret documents had expired. Is that why they were finally disclosed, or did something make them disclosable?
Well, they were disclosed during a mass declassification. It was just an Army major at the time took a look at the collection, and for some reason he declassified the entire collection. He didn't even note that there were reasons to hold those documents back under the Privacy Act, because there were things like Social Security numbers in there, which normally would be redacted. So when I found them, there had been no redactions made. In the time since, after I published my first article on these documents, they were withdrawn from the public shelves. And that was around 10 years ago, and they haven't been returned to the public shelves since.
Once again, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. My name is Garland Nixon. I'm here with Mark Levine, and this is News Views on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. And tonight we have with us Nick Turk, the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Groundbreaking reporting here. It was the publication date is January 15th, 2013, so this is a new book. Where can they get the book, Nick?
It should be available at all major bookstores, and of course online at Amazon and Barnes and Noble, and it should be out there for people who are interested.
Kill Anything That Moves: The Real American War in Vietnam by Nick Turst. It's a winner of the Reidenhauer Prize for Reportorial Distinction. Great book, and it's one you need to read. The other thing about war, and I mean, I'm sure that in time we will discover very, very similar things about Iraq and Afghanistan that were withheld from us. But the thing about it is we look at a massacre like My Lai in horror, which we should be horrified. But the other thing we don't talk about, from the perspective of massacres, is the bombing, which oftentimes, many, many more people are killed. I mean, B-52s dropping massive, 60,000 pounds of ordnance at a time from 30,000 feet or whatever it is, and destroying and flattening entire villages. I mean, I think probably some of the worst massacres in Vietnam, we probably didn't have anyone on the ground to see them, but they were as a result of carpet bombing. Did you have any? Is there anything in there about bombing or any of the bombing, the massive bombing runs that went on in Vietnam?
Yes, the cases that we've mentioned, things like massacres and murders, these micro level atrocities, they punctuate the book, but I really try and tell a larger story of Vietnamese civilian suffering, and it's really the heavy firepower that you're talking about that ended up, killing and wounding most civilians. There's only so much killing a squad or platoon or company can do. Troops on the ground, they don't have the firepower to kill the way that that artillery, helicopter gunships, and bombers do. And that's how most Vietnamese died. We'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died in the war, but the best estimates we have indicate about 2 million civilian dead. Add to that 5.3 million civilian wounded using a very cautious method of estimation. The U.S. government came up with a count of about 11 million Vietnamese made refugees during the war, and the latest studies show that as many as 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. Mm. So you have suffering on an almost unimaginable scale, and it's really the industrial side of war, bombing and shelling helicopters, that's able to carry this out. And it's also the story that Vietnamese told me when I went to Vietnam. I went with these stacks of documents to try and find witnesses and survivors to individual cases. I'd go to talk about one specific event, but what they would tell me about was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate every aspect of their life around what they call the American War. There were just constant calculations about when to leave the bomb shelter to try and forage for food or get water or relieve oneself. All these mundane activities, the stuff of everyday life, but for them, it was a constant series of calculations to figure out how to stay alive and how to keep your family alive. And it was the heavy firepower that most disrupted their lives.
Nick, the title of your book, Kill Anything That Moves, is certainly evocative. I guess my question for you is, in your researching this treasure trove or horror trove of documents, were you able to determine this order, kill anything that moves? Was that the standard order, which basically says don't make any distinction between combatants and civilians? Or was that something that people certainly just sort of felt to be true? Or is that something where people are in the field and they don't know who's a combatant, who's a civilian, and they just kill anything that moves? Was that sort of standard policy, or was that something that was lower down?
Well, the phrase itself, I noticed, kept popping up in various records. When I looked at Army investigation files for a massacre that was carried out in February 1968 by Army troops, I noticed the West Point trained officer who was the head of the unit used that phrase, kill anything that moves, and it stuck in my head. And as I looked elsewhere, I found it in the phrase repeated in a 1967 court-martial of Marines for a different massacre. I found it in a pilot talking about being given this order in 1972. I noticed it popping up again and again, and I came to see it as a shorthand for how the war was really fought. You mentioned that just firing on anyone, and this was often the case. American troops were told that they could fire on those taking quote unquote evasive action. And this is how they would call it in: one guerrilla killed, taking evasive action.
And what we call is running for their lives.
Exactly. Again and again, I found this in the documents, that there'd be farmers out working in their fields. A helicopter gunship would hover overhead. The people would stand there for a while, and finally they'd get extremely afraid. Sometimes the helicopter would drop down and buzz them and frighten them into running, and once they did run, then the troops had carte blanche to fire on them. And this happened again and again. And troops were also told that, that to kill anyone in black pajamas, they called it, which was the loose-fitting black clothes that the Vietnamese guerrillas wore, but it was also the standard garb of the peasants in Vietnam. This is what people out in the villages wore. But when helicopters came overhead, they said, we see people in black pajamas and fire on them. So that's how civilians were killed in droves because of this, because of the way the American war was fought.
I'd be curious to know, obviously, the Viet Cong were men. There weren't too many women that I know of in the Viet Cong, and I don't know of too many children either. So whereas you could argue about whether a man was in the Viet Cong or not, you'd have very little argument about women or children. Were you able to document what percentage of those killed by U.S. troops were women or children?
Yeah, I have the numbers in my book on the number of women and children who were wounded and ended up in hospitals. And, I'm blanking on the number right now, but I think it was around 55% of the wounded in Vietnamese provincial hospitals during the war.
The majority were women and children. That's,
yeah.
Wow.
And, this is, but there was a mythology among GIs, and they were taught this from boot camp, that, that women were probably in league with the Viet Cong, that they were the wives or girlfriends of Viet Cong fighters, that they might be armed, that children might have a grenade. And this, and of course it this did happen from time to time, but it certainly wasn't the norm. But many of the veterans that I interviewed said that they were told from day one in boot camp that it was safer to shoot first because no one was going to ask questions later.
And, that says something, on the broader picture, about our society. We send people over there, and how we dehumanize and view other people in this country. And to be honest with you, you tend to think that if it was, say, Kosovo, that wasn't going to happen in Kosovo, that wasn't going to happen in, Eastern Europe or in the Balkans or something like that, But when it comes to a Vietnam, when it comes to a, Middle East or someplace like that, that to be quite honest, it appears as though our country dehumanizes, often people of color. And it seems that those are the countries that we end up, bombing and attacking the most, and B, being the most inhumane and vicious with.
That's exactly right. I really found a racist component to the war as I studied this. There was an acronym used in Vietnam called the MGR, or the Mere Gook Rule. The idea was that the Vietnamese weren't real people. They were subhuman, mere gooks who could be abused or killed at will. And veterans told me that that they were steeped in this from the moment they got to boot camp, to basic training. They were told, you never call them Vietnamese. You call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, anything to dehumanize the Vietnamese, anything to make it easier to kill them. And I talked to a lot of minority veterans who told me that they realized that it was racist. They realized that this was similar to the slurs that they had heard back in their hometowns in the U.S. But the fact that it was repeated again and again during boot camp, during advanced infantry training, when they got to Vietnam, they felt that it was almost inescapable, and they found themselves using that terminology, even if they recognized that it was racist.
And yet we were ostensibly on the side of the South Vietnamese. We were supposedly helping one segment of Vietnamese fight another segment of Vietnamese. How the heck did we know who were our allies?
Well, I mean, this was a lot of times U.S. troops did have a tough time figuring out friend from foe in Vietnam, and a lot of times they just didn't take the time to try and sort things out. And this racism, it really was pervasive, and you talk to veterans and they say that they really didn't see any distinction. In fact, many of them say that the only Vietnamese that they had any respect for were their enemies, the Viet Cong, and that they despised their allies, the South Vietnamese Army, and also civilians, because they just didn't trust them. They had a respect for the enemy, but all other Vietnamese were generally gooks or dinks to them.
And ultimately, in a broad sense, I mean, albeit a very, very flawed and probably self-serving and even untrue argument, the argument there had nothing to do with helping the why we were there. The whole domino theory, and we were stopping communism or whatever. It really, that had nothing to do with helping the South Vietnamese. It was all allegedly to help us in the first place.
That's right. I mean, there was lip service paid to, helping, create an independent South Vietnam, but the U.S. continued to support one corrupt government after another there. They talked about nation building the same way we hear about it today.
Right.
But just a tiny percentage of money was geared towards projects that helped the Vietnamese. And, of course, most of it went to heavy ordnance and firepower that rained down upon the Vietnamese.
Well, thank you very much. Once again, you're listening to Nick Terse, our guest. My name is Garland Nixon. I'm here with Mark Levine. You're listening to News Views on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. The book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, Nick Terse. It's the winner of the Reidenhauer Prize for Reportorial Distinction. Excellent book. I suggest that you get it. Just came out in January 15th, 2013. We're going to get ready to, we'll be getting ready to, go to an announcement here for a minute or so, and we'll be back. Nick, I want to thank you, and we're certainly going to have you back. I understand you do some other stuff, so we're going to have you back on the show sometime again soon.
Great. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Listen to WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. Be right back. Hi, my name is Garland Nixon. You're listening to News Views here on WPFW every Friday from 6 to 7. I'm here with Mark Levine, my esteemed panelist. And making this all happen is Bill Witherspoon. Bill is out there in the land with all the slides and the blinking lights and all of those things that I don't understand, making sure that the show happens and the guests are on and all the wonderful things happen. But look, here's something very important. After the show, you've got to listen to Robin's Place with Robin Holden and Carol Tyson. They're going to have, listen to this, all-female vocalist and instrumentalist tonight, Sweet Honey on the Rock, Cassandra Wilson, Bette Midler, Ronnie Wells. I mean, there's going to be some really, really good music. So after listening into some great talk shows, some great public affairs stuff here on WPFW, 7 o'clock, Robin's Place is going to have some top-quality music. That's what makes WPFW so good, and that's why you should have it locked in on your home radio. You should have it locked in on your computer. You should have it locked in on your car radio, and you should be listening to 89.3 FM WPFW all the time. Is that right, Mark?
Absolutely.
Okay. We're the second half of the show from 6:30 to 7. Something we're going to talk about, something very, very important. The Maryland General Assembly approved a measure Friday to repeal the state's death penalty. The House of Delegates voted 82 to 56 Friday to pass a bill already approved by the Senate. According to the AP, Maryland might make the 18th state to ban capital punishment. A guy who I just absolutely think the world of, Governor Martin O'Malley, is expected to sign the bill, and that's wonderful. And we have, I believe, Stephanie Love, or Sarah, is it Stephanie or Sarah?
Sarah.
Sarah Love from the ACLU, one of my favorite organizations. The ACLU has been fighting this battle to end the death penalty for many, many years. Welcome to WPFW, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. And as a former board member, I'm happy to be on your show in particular, Garland. Thank you.
Thank you. A lot of people don't know that. I was a former board member for the ACLU Foundation in Maryland. In fact, I was vice president at one time. And I am still, I love the ACLU. Mark, my esteemed panelist, Mark, who actually happens to be a constitutional attorney himself, is a big-time supporter of the ACLU.
Absolutely. I used to work for Congressman Barney Frank, and certainly he worked with and for and took advice from the ACLU for many years while he served in Congress.
So let's celebrate together, and let's talk about the ACLU, what's happening with you guys, what your thoughts are on this change, what the ACLU has been doing in general with the about the death. Let's talk about the death penalty a little bit.
Well, we are just thrilled about today, and we are so proud of those members of the General Assembly, and to Governor O'Malley for his leadership, Delegate Rosenberg, who led the fight on the House floor, and Senator Jamie Raskin, who led the fight on the Senate floor. The ACLU, as you know, has been working to abolish the death penalty across the country for many, many years, and we were so happy to be a part of a great coalition who brought us to today. We're just thrilled.
Sarah, one of the major concerns that many Americans have with the death penalty, even those who support it in theory, have problems with the way it's implemented in practice. The former Republican governor of Illinois, for example, was fine with it in theory, but in practice, what it means is that poor people are much less likely to get executed than rich people. They can't afford the good lawyers and so forth. Can you give us some idea of the scope of the problem nationwide with people getting inadequate access to counsel and people like Kirk Bloodsworth, who was on our show a year or so back, actually innocent people being convicted of the death penalty?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have those stats in front of me, but I do know I'm a born and bred Chicagoan. Mm-hmm. So I remember when the governor went through that. And now being finding Maryland my home, what we have found is at least 75% of all homicide victims in Maryland are African American. Yet we find the death penalty is disproportionately applied for those who kill whites. So all five of the men who are on death row right now are there for killing whites. We also see that imposing the death penalty is, as you said, it's imposed more likely on poor, it's imposed more likely on African Americans, and it's imposed more likely on certain jurisdictions, so that it is racially and jurisdictionally biased. And that's one of the reasons that across the country people are finding that it just doesn't work.
Over the course of the show, I'm going to read a couple here and there. I'm going to read a couple stories about people who were wrongly accused. There's a man named Kennedy Brewer from Mississippi. Kennedy Brewer spent 12 years on Mississippi's death row for the 1992 murder and rape of his girlfriend's 3-year-old daughter. He has been exonerated of the charges, and another man, Justin Johnson, has been arrested for the same crime. A 2001 investigation by the Innocent Project found that the semen on the victim's body did not match Brewer's DNA, but did match Johnson's. Johnson was a suspect early in the case, and his blood was collected and preserved in Mississippi for more than 10 years. Now, here's the problem. Even worse. Well, not worse, but just as bad. Despite the result of the 2001 DNA testing, the Mississippi Supreme Court denied Brewer's request for a new trial in 2002. Brewer eventually won a retrial from and was reduced. This man spent 12 years on death row for a rape that he did not commit. And even after DNA showed that it was another person, it was an African-American man in Mississippi. Well, we need not get into that. But even after it was found that someone else did it in 2001, he still didn't get out for five more years. And just to show, I mean, even when it was proven that the man didn't do it, just to show how biased this system can be against poor people and people of color.
Absolutely. And there are many, many more stories just like those. I think the numbers are 142, mm-hmm. I believe, people who have been exonerated, people who were on death row and subsequently exonerated. So, you know, there are just horrible stories out there.
142 innocent people convicted of a capital offense and were about to undergo the death penalty if it had not been for DNA or other evidence exonerating them. That's 142. That bears repeating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And here's something important to think about, because as Mark knows and many of my listeners know, I'm a retired law enforcement officer. In fact, I was a law enforcement official. And at one point in my career, I did a lot of things, but I was the commander of the investigations division at one point. And what a lot of people don't realize when they talk about DNA, because one of the discussions, one of the arguments that people say is that, you know, well, DNA evidence will get them off. In most murders, there is no DNA evidence. In rape, sometime there's semen. Sometime if there was a fight, there's blood. But in most murders, in many instances, you know, someone is standing somewhere or sitting in a car and bullets are fired from a point, you know, a distance away. Many, many times, there's no DNA evidence. The person didn't do it. But there's no DNA evidence to go into court, and there's nothing but some flimsy, you know, alleged eyewitness who oftentimes is a people would be a person in jail trying to, you know, get a lighter sentence themselves. So what background do you have, if you don't mind me asking, what background do you have regarding the death penalty? Have you ever been involved in any death penalty or working on this issue before?
I was clerking for a judge, Judge Timothy Lewis, on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Pennsylvania, when I was out of law school. And up until that point, I hadn't thought too much about the death penalty, but I thought, oh, well, you know, it's probably a good idea. You know, we should, you know, get these terrible people out of our society. And then we had a capital case on appeal. Mm-hmm. And I began to study it. And what I found is that the jurisprudence, that means the case law around it, was so confusing that I, a lawyer, couldn't figure it out.
Wow.
And I saw so much bias in the system. And there was so much that was left to people's discretion that was then manifested through their bias. They chose certain paths to prosecute certain people, as we've talked, African Americans and poor people. And I became so disgusted with the death penalty in our society, and I realized that it is just broken, it cannot be fixed, and it must be abolished.
You know, I think people are sometimes under the misimpression that the ACLU is there. If you're just a criminal defense attorney, you're charged with a crime, you've got the ACLU right there. If you're charged with a capital crime, the ACLU would love to be there, but of course there are millions of crimes prosecuted every year, and certainly thousands of capital cases, and you just don't have the resources to be there for everybody. So, I mean, what can you do? How can the ACLU choose between all of these very difficult cases and help some but neglect others? It must be a horrible choice.
Well, a lot of the time, we are not the primary counsel. We are there in support of the Office of the Public Defender or, you know, attorneys who are doing this, most likely pro bono, not getting paid. Mm-hmm. We'll file amicus briefs. We'll support them in any way that you can. But, you know, as you said, it's a really tough thing because there are a lot of cases out there. And this work is not the only work that we do. We're out there fighting for First Amendment free speech. We're out there fighting for your privacy, for your Fourth Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have, like so many others, a lot on our plate.
And as I know from my past experience, one of the things that the ACLU does, since they can't take every case, is that to such as in instances like the death penalty and marriage choice and various and other things, fight and help get legislation through. that in a broad sense will address these things, since they can't do them one by one. And you know, to a large extent, you know, I know the that can be more important. I mean, not to the individual who's on death row, but if you can stop it the next 100 years, you can stop people from being on death row, or from at least being executed, that otherwise, you know, wouldn't have had an opportunity.
Yes, that's very true. And actually, I thank you for the shout out, because that's my job. I'm the public policy director, so I appreciate that. We do work very hard to pass laws that will have an impact on a number of people.
How difficult is it for someone who is accused of a crime, who is innocent, and who is poor, too poor to afford a Johnny Cochran or a Barry Scheck, someone like Kirk Bloodsworth, who we've had on our show, or anyone else? What happens? They go to the public defender. How overworked are public defenders in our country? How hard is it for someone, an innocent person, to get adequate representation if charged with a crime?
You know, it really varies. I have the utmost respect for the Office of the Public Defender. These people work very, very hard. They are overloaded. You know, they do their very best. There are also, however, some other folks out there who do represent poor folks charged with capital crimes who do not do a good job. I mean, we've heard horrible stories about capital cases where the lawyer slept through the trial, or, you know, I heard one story where the lawyer was drunk during the trial.
Yeah, I know that it was a case in Texas where George W. Bush approved the execution of a guy whose lawyer slept through the trial. Apparently, Governor George W. Bush didn't see any problem with executing a guy, even though his lawyer fell asleep. But I guess my point is that if you're rich, you can afford rich man's justice. And if you're poor, I mean, I don't know how the Office of Public Defender can deal with the thousands of cases that come across. Most of these cases are plea bargained, right? I mean, the vast majority of people don't even get a chance to go to trial, even if they're innocent, because they think they're going to be railroaded anyway.
Well, another thing that happens, unfortunately, and, you know, you end up with confessions where a person was interrogated for hours and, you know, denied sleep and scared to death, and ultimately told something to the effect of, you know, you're going to get the death penalty if, you know, if you go ahead and, you know, if you confess, then, you know, we'll say something to help you out. And a person confesses in fear and ends up getting a death penalty anyway, but they didn't do it. Let's talk about another gentleman named Jonathan Hoffman, North Carolina. He was convicted in 1995. Prosecutors in North Carolina on December 11, 2007, dropped all charges against Jonathan Hoffman, who had been convicted and sentenced to death for the 1995 murder of a jewelry store owner. Hoffman won a new trial in 2004 because information favorable to Hoffman was withheld from the defense. During Hoffman's first trial, the state's key witness, John L. Porter, received immunity from federal charges for testifying against his cousin. In fact, Porter received thousands of dollars for his testimony. Neither the defense attorney nor the judge knew of the deal, an omission that resulted in the criminal investigation of Ken Honeycutt and Scott Brewer, the prosecutors in the original trial. Porter has since recanted his testimony, stating that he lied in order to get back at his cousin for stealing money from him. Defense attorney Joseph Cheshire stated, "I think in the last 5 to 6 years, there's a fairly well demonstrated pattern of wrongful convictions in North Carolina that are only now coming to light because of our new open discovery law." Hoffman, a black man charged with killing a white man, was tried and convicted by an all-white jury, despite the fact that no physical evidence connected him to the murder of Danny Cook. He was finally released in 2007. He spent 12 years on death row. And I think that is a perfect example of what we're talking about here, isn't it?
It is. And as we've been discussing, there are so many of these stories out there. And that's why we know that the death penalty just doesn't work, and we need to get rid of it.
Yeah, and I mean, when we look at this, you had pretty much all the bad things wrapped up in one on this guy. You know, you hear all the many bad things that happen and the things that cause our system to be unreliable. And here we have a man where the key witness was paid thousands of dollars, where the key witness admitted lying, where there was evidence withheld from the judge that could have—I mean, from the court that could have exonerated him, and of course, this is never hard to believe—he was a black man charged with killing a white man facing an all-white jury in North Carolina.
Sarah, I'd like to ask you about Maryland's vote. And because Maryland, as I recall, used to abolish the death penalty, and then a few years back they put it in, and now they're abolishing it again. Good for Maryland. Do you think that this is a trend? You know, we talked about Governor Ryan in Illinois. Was there a trend towards the death penalty 10, 20 years ago, and now the trend is away from it? Can we say that?
I would think so. Once the Supreme Court abolished the death penalty, or they said it was unconstitutional, states abolished it. Then when the Supreme Court reversed itself and said, no, you know, it's okay, Maryland took a little while before it reinstated the death penalty. And now we had, a debate on this in 2009. We came very close to abolishing it in 2009. The cases that were eligible for the death penalty were substantially narrowed, and as you know, today we voted to repeal it. And I do think there is a trend across the country. Connecticut just voted to repeal the death penalty. There are other states that are looking into this. So I think people are starting to realize that it's racially, jurisdictionally biased, that it is not a deterrent, that it costs society so much money that it's really just time to get rid of it once and for all.
At one time, I think half the capital cases were in Texas. Is that still true?
I believe that it is. Texas and Florida, I believe, are the two. And one of the things that was mentioned several times on the floor today is the countries that execute the most people. The United States is up there with Iran, Iraq, North Korea, China. I mean, is this the company that we want to be keeping?
Yeah.
Is that where we want to be rated?
And doesn't that tell us something about our society and, you know, who we can be compared to? There's another one last individual I want to bring to our listeners' attention. His name is Curtis Edward McCarty. He was convicted in 1986. His charges were dismissed in 2007. He spent 22 years behind bars for the murder of a police officer's daughter in 1982. 16 of those years on death row. The judge ruled that the case against McCarty was tainted by the questionable testimony of a former police chemist, Joyce Gilchrist, who gave improper expert testimony about semen and hair evidence. Gilchrist falsely testified that hairs and other biological evidence showed that McCarty could have been the killer. In both trials, the juries convicted him and he was sentenced to death. In Gilchrist's original notes, hairs from the crime scene did not match McCarty. She then changed her notes to say that the hairs did match him. When the defense requested retesting, she said the hairs were lost.
Now, why can't we charge Gilchrist?
Listen to this. DNA and testing in recent years has shown that another person raped the victim. This man was 100% innocent. He spent 16 years on death row, 22 years behind bars because a police chemist lied and changed their report. And this didn't even.
I'd want to prosecute that police chemist. Does that ever happen, Sarah, where you actually could prosecute the people who wrongfully convict other people?
You know, I would hope so. I don't know of any cases where that has happened, but I would certainly hope so. And, you know, if you think about it, how many more of these are out there that we just don't know about?
Right.
And these are just a few we've heard about.
Yeah, these are the ones that come to light, and you would think that they'd have an incentive to keep this kind of stuff secret.
Yeah, no, I remember when I was in law enforcement, I remember of an incident that came to light on the Eastern Shore where an African-American man who was a migrant worker back then, way back. This is in the 80s, I believe. He was a migrant worker. He was accused of raping a white woman. He couldn't read and write. Mm. He didn't have any money for a lawyer. He was on the Lower Eastern Shore. He was convicted. He spent 3 years in jail for rape, maintained his innocence the whole time. The woman eventually came to Baltimore. She accused a lot of other people of raping her. Eventually, they looked into her background and found that there was a number of this had been a pattern. Apparently, I guess she had some mental illness. But this was the only guy who went to jail and had been in jail for 3 years. So we look at the death penalty and we see the reason that these stand out is because of the potential for the death penalty. But we look at that and it tells us that our system is really set up to work against people who are impoverished, people of color, people who don't have a way of defending themselves. And so I'm really glad that the ACLU is there to fight for people who can't. And I certainly ask all of our listeners to, you know, of course, we want everybody to be members of WPFW, but the ACLU is a valuable organization, and certainly ask our members to go to there. What's your website again?
It's www.aclu-md.org.
aclu-md.org. Well, thank you very much, and we ask all of our listeners, if you're out there, go to aclu-md.org. You can go on there. What can they find on your website, by the way?
They can find a number of things. They can find cases that we're working on. They can find laws that we're working on. They can find, if they need legal help, they can find ways to reach out to us. They can certainly donate to us. A lot of information about your rights, about what we're doing to defend your rights.
And I understand you've had some the one thing that a lot of people have found very, very interesting and of note is the ACLU's case against racial profiling, case with the Maryland State Police. I understand that that's still, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it still dragging on?
It is still dragging on. We are still trying to get compliance with the Maryland State Police. We were actually the first state to do a driving while black case. We did it with our national office. We get great, great support from our national office. And that was in the early 1990s. So this case has been going on for a very long time. And right now what we're doing is trying to make sure that the Maryland State Police is keeping records of who they stop and why to ensure that they are not continuing to racially profile.
Yes. Well, I certainly, and you know, it's kind of funny when I think about it. Well, not really funny, but when I think about it, you know, these are things that as an African-American male are things that really hit home to me. I mean, to be honest, any black man who's out in society always has a fear. It's way deep down there, but there's always a fear that you're going to be grabbed for some crime that you didn't commit and end up in jail. You know, we don't discuss it, but any black man, I'm guaranteeing you that any black man listening to this show right now, way back in the back of his mind, always has a fear that he's going to be grabbed. And God forbid you should buy a nice car. Well, that's, you're guaranteed there's going to be at some point blue lights behind you and you're going to be accused of being a drug dealer.
To me, that was the lesson of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, and why it was so horrible that he was stopped at his own home accused of breaking in. I mean, you know, here you have a Harvard professor, but he's still a black man in America.
Right. And unfortunately, when it comes to racial profiling, that's one of the things that's unique to black people. And that is, you know, we all know that in our society that there are two different sets of laws for the wealthy and there's a set of laws for the wealthy and a set for the poor, and that more so holds with people who are not of color, with the majority race of white people. When it comes to black people, whether you're poor or rich, regardless of your economic circumstance, when law enforcement stop you, they're probably going to view you in the same light. Well, I hate to go, but we have to go. I want to thank you very much, and we're certainly going to keep in touch with you when you want to do something on medical marijuana soon, and we'll certainly have the ACLU back on for that.
That would be terrific. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you tonight.
Thanks. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. The show is News Views 6 to 7 every Friday. Garland Nixon and Mark Levine, thank you.